We are also starting a new series today, and we're calling it Follow. And it's what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. We're calling it Joining in the Way of Jesus. And this week, we want to look at how we get close to Jesus. I think there's probably no more important thing that we could be looking at as a church in this cultural moment than what it means to be a disciple, to be a follower, to be a learner, to be an apprentice of Jesus. Partly because we've seen so many people come to faith in Jesus over the last 3-4 months in particular, but also because for each of us, this is the most important thing that we're called to in our lives. We're called to follow Jesus. And so what we're going to do over the next few weeks is look at the words that Jesus himself speaks in the eyewitness accounts of his life about what it means to be someone who is learning from Jesus, someone who is following Jesus. And we're going to start today, Matthew 4 and Matthew 16. So Matthew 4 from verse 18. As Jesus was walking beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon called Peter and his brother Andrew. They were casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. Come, follow me, Jesus said, and I will send you out to fish for people. At once they left their nets and followed him. Going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. They were in a boat with their father Zebedee, preparing their nets. Jesus called them, and immediately they left the boat and their father and followed him. And then in Matthew 16, from verse 24. Then Jesus said to his disciples, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? The first thing we see in this passage is that Jesus invites you to follow him. He says, come, follow me. It's simple, it's clear, and the initiative comes from Jesus to us. And I just want to pause and just say, this is one of the most extraordinary things in the universe. It's one of the things that sets Christianity apart from almost every other faith and creed, is that we don't worship a God who is distant and separate from this world, but we worship a God who took flesh in Jesus. God made flesh in Jesus and walked amongst us, set up camp amongst us, but didn't even stop there, then came even closer to us and invited us to be in a partnership, to be in a relationship, to be in a training relationship with him. It's an extraordinary thing that God himself might invite you to learn from him in such a proximate, intimate relationship that you might even be his apprentice. You might be his learner. And the word disciple sounds a little bit unusual in our current cultural context, a bit strange. But it really means to be someone who follows, someone who learns. It's like the word apprentice. And actually, that might seem like quite a lot, quite a commitment, but one of the questions of life is not, you know, are you going to be shaped? It's who or what is shaping you. Yeah. There's so much going on in our world, in our culture that shapes us. Sometimes we're aware of it, sometimes we're not. In Romans 12, one of the translations is, don't be shaped by the world. Don't let the world squeeze you into its mold, but be transformed by God. And Jesus calls you to be a disciple, to be a learner, to be an apprentice of him, and to the Christian life begins and ends with this call to be a disciple. It's not like there's two categories, Christians and then disciples. I love the word Christian. I think it's an absolutely vital word for our cultural moment because it's resonant in our culture, and our culture still sometimes understands what it means to be someone of Christ. But what is a Christian? A Christian is someone who follows Jesus. A Christian is someone who is a disciple of Jesus. So it's not like when you respond to Jesus, they're like, look, you've got two options. On the one hand, you could pick the easy option. You're just a Christian. So we just sprinkle some kind of spiritual dust on the existing reality of your life. You don't have to change much. Sing a few songs, turn up a few times a year, be a bit nicer to people in general. You're a Christian. Well done. But if you want the advanced option, come this way. You know, you can be a disciple. This is like for the Marines of the spiritual world. We're going to ask a lot of you. We're going to call you to task. We're going to give you lots of habits and practices to build into your life. No. When Jesus calls you, he calls you to follow him. Every person is called into a relationship with Jesus of such proximity and intention that you become a follower, you become a disciple, you become an apprentice. And to do that, you have to get close to Jesus. The question isn't, you know, who should I be, a Christian or a disciple? The question is, how closely are you following Jesus? One of the only times in the gospel that says that someone followed Jesus at a distance is when Peter followed him at a distance and ended up denying him. You want to follow Jesus closely. And Jesus' model is like a master to an apprentice, like a trainer to an apprentice. It's like learning a trade. So when they train you how to be a butcher, your first day, you don't go in and the kind of head butcher hands you like, you know, a meat cleaver, a knife, and a cow, and says, good luck. It's not how it works. You know, you're right next to them for weeks and months, and you see how they do things, and you learn. You know, when you learn a trade as a mechanic, it's not like they hand you like a big book and a screwdriver and a wrench and a Porsche and say, all the best. You know, it's like, no, you watch how they do the job, and you learn as an apprentice by watching the master at work. And this is what I found when I was training to be a lawyer, because there are two stages to training to be a lawyer. There's like the kind of theory side. You do a whole year at law school. For me, I was a barrister, so it was called bar school. It's so boring. It could not be more boring. It's like you basically do weeks and weeks of work on procedure and criminal procedure and civil procedure and commercial procedure and other procedure, and you're literally so boring. There's no people, nothing's changing. And then after that year, just when you're about to give up, they give you your on-the-job training. And then suddenly it comes to life. I still remember my first day, because the way it works as a barrister is you have what's called a pupillage, because you are a pupil and you have a pupil master. So you're like the apprentice and they are the trainer. And the way it works is still quite old school in one sense, because you come in and you basically have a little seat on the edge of their desk, because you have to be watching them 24/7 to see how they do the job, so you will know how to do the job. My first day, I turned up at court, and the very experienced barrister, amazing barrister, he was like, this is how it's going to work. You're going to be with me all the time. We're going to work together. We're going to eat together. We're going to go everywhere together. We're going to travel together. We're going to be in court together. We're going to da-da-da. I was like, right, okay. I was like, this is different. This is like an immersive training experience. Then he said, let's go to the cells. I said, I've never been to the cells before. He said, well, good, because otherwise we couldn't have given you a job. But now, you know, but let's go to the cells now. And I was like, okay, right, you know. And suddenly I was in the cells. You know, you're like, wow. He's like, here's the client, you know, you're like, you're meeting an armed robber, you know, it's first someone who's accused of being an armed robber, and you know, you're kind of, you know, it's like the first day. You're like, I'm out of my depth. But he was there and he was showing me how to do things. I saw how he spoke with his client, treated his client with care and respect. And then how he treated the judge and how he treated the court staff and how he treated his opponent and how he argued the case, all these different things. We went with him, you know, when he was with other colleagues, and we went for food or for a drink or something like that. I saw socially how he acted. I learned so much. I was like a sponge. It was the most invaluable training. And it even got to a stage where I think he felt a bit sorry for me and he wanted to kind of help me out. So after a few weeks, I remember we're in court early together. He said, Steve, who taught you to tie a tie? I said, no one taught me to tie. I taught myself to tie a tie. He said, Steve, that tie looks like it's a footballer's tie. I was like, is that a good thing? He said, it's not a good thing. And then he taught me there, you know, 8 a.m. at a court, how to tie this like really tight, aggressive knot around my neck. And then a few weeks later, he said, Steve, can I just check, where do you get your suits from? I was like, Suits Direct. He was like, Steve, that's not kind of what you need now. He's like, wrote me a check for £500 and said, go to a tailor, get a proper suit. He was like invested in me. He wanted to help me. He was committed to me. I learned so much. I was like a sponge. It's like the teacher, the apprentice, side by side. But if I'd have kind of turned up thinking, you know, well, I actually got quite a good degree. I know quite a lot about law. I've read a book on criminal procedure. What have you got to teach me? I don't think I would have learned much. If I'd have phoned him on the first day and said, well, you know, you're quite a good barrister, but I don't think you're top 10 in the UK. I'll go and learn off someone else. It wouldn't have worked. It's almost like when the pupil is ready, the master appears. And you're invited into a relationship with the most extraordinary trainer who's ever walked on the face of the earth. And he says, come, follow me. Come, be my apprentice. There's an ancient saying from kind of Jewish Midrash, which is that a wise disciple is covered in the dust of their rabbi. And some people think that means, well, you know, that means that you're so close to them that even when they sit down to eat at a low table, their feet are near you, and so you're near the dust on their feet. But actually, more people think it's actually in that context when you walked fast or when you walked around, you would kick up dust behind you. And so it's almost the idea that a disciple is so close to their rabbi that as they move around, as they go through life, they're just covered in the dust that their rabbi kicks up. So what does that look like? Well, Ditya is going to come and show me. Ditya, come up. Would you welcome up Ditya? So it's a little bit like this. So it's a bit like, you know, actually, I've got far more to learn from Ditya than he has from me. But just for the purpose of this illustration, imagine I'm the rabbi and Ditya is the disciple. And so I would go off here and I'd say, Ditya, come and see how I pray. And then he'd get some dust on him that way. And I'd say, come and see how I read the Bible, Ditya. And then he would get some more dust on him. And I'd say, oh, we're going to go. Come and see how I treat this kind of person. And he'd get some more dust on him there. And then I'd say, oh, no, come over here. I'm going to teach you how to live and do that together. Oh, it's going up as well as down now. So maybe I have to be a little bit careful. Oh, white shoes. And as we went through life, as Ditya was proximate to me, and I was passing on stuff to him, he would, without me even really trying it, just because we're in proximity and he's seeing how I live this life, he would get covered in the dust I'm stirring up. And so in that context, in that culture, the way it would work was the disciple and the dust that the disciple carried was proof of their proximity to their rabbi. The dust signifies the lessons, the experience, the wisdom, the mentoring, the investment that the disciple has received from the rabbi. And so when Jesus says, come, follow me, it's almost like Jesus is saying, get dusty. Get so close to me that you will carry and be covered in my dust. Would you thank Ditya? Thanks. Just sort this out. But it's so interesting there, because to do that, you have to be prepared to follow. And when you follow, you surrender some of your autonomy. Yes. And if you're like me, it's quite hard to surrender autonomy. Because, you know, if you're following, they choose the direction. They choose the route. They choose the things you're going to do. And you just have to follow. That can be a hard thing for us to do. So much talk about leadership in our generation. But I think one of the challenges is that we don't have many people who are prepared to follow. And we probably need to talk more about followership and what good followership looks like in the context of good leadership. Because if following people is beneath you, then leading people is probably going to be beyond you. And it's only, I think, as we are prepared to follow hard after Jesus that we can be entrusted with leading others. Jesus says, come, follow me. Get close, get dusty. Then the second thing we see here is Jesus promises to form you in his likeness. He says, come, follow me, and I will make you into fishers of people. It's so important. The disciples were going to be formed. They were going to be shaped. The word disciple, it's a noun. It's not a verb, but it's an identity, not an achievement. But disciples are made. They're not just discovered. They're forged. They're not just found. To be a disciple is to be someone who is being made into something new, something distinct by Jesus. Jesus says, come follow me and I will, the word is poesuo, I will make you into something. Straight away, the first time Jesus calls someone to follow him, it becomes clear to us that you cannot follow Jesus and remain unchanged. Jesus isn't passive or uninterested in your journey of faith. Jesus is active and committed to forming you and to shaping you. And often when we start talking about what it means to be a disciple, we quite quickly jump to, these are the 7 or 8 things you need in your life. These are the habits you need to adopt. This is the rule of life you need to put in place. And that stuff is all good, but it's only possible because of Jesus's prior commitment and promise to you to form and shape you into something distinct from what you already are. And I want to be honest with you, if I can just speak vulnerably. For large periods of my life, I have felt like quite a rubbish Christian. For significant seasons of my life, I felt like a bit of an inadequate disciple. Like sometimes I feel like, oh, maybe I'm too proud. And then sometimes I feel like maybe I'm too fearful. Sometimes I feel like maybe I'm too driven. Sometimes I feel like maybe I'm not driven enough. Sometimes I feel like, well, maybe I'm too focused on the theory. Sometimes I feel like maybe I'm too focused on just getting things done. Sometimes I think maybe I'm too contemplative. Sometimes I feel like maybe I'm too action orientated. And if at times I felt like I needed to read the Bible more, pray more, fast more, get better at doing a Sabbath. And if being a disciple is all on you, in my experience, you'll tend to swing from pride to despair and back again. You know, when you're nailing it, when it's going well, when you feel like you're doing well in the spiritual realm, you'll be like, I'm a disciple with a capital D. Everyone else can step back. I'm part of the elite. I'm not like these people who just turn up to church. I have practices in my life. I've got a rule of life. It's proper. It's sustained. I'm committed to it. I'm nailing it. I'm in the deeper levels. I've reached the higher end, all that kind of stuff. And you can be tempted to be a little bit self-righteous, a little bit superior, a little bit like you're special. And then when it's going badly, you're tempted to despair. You're like, who am I kidding? I fell asleep praying last night. I've made 8 mistakes this week. I had that difficult conversation with someone. Even my best efforts are tainted by mixed motives. And maybe I should just avoid church. Maybe I should just avoid my group. Maybe I should just leave this whole ministry thing to the holier, shinier people who seem to have it all together. And I tell you, it has been the hugest possible encouragement in my life to realize that Jesus is active in my formation and Jesus is the most important actor in my formation. That he promises that I will make you. And the times when I have grown most in my life are the times when he has stirred a new passion in me. Yes, it takes discipline. Yes, it takes focus to follow Jesus. Yes, habits are hugely helpful. But most of all, we need the Holy Spirit to set our hearts on fire with love for God. I love this from Jesus in Matthew 16:24. He says, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself. If anyone desires to come after me, let them deny themselves, take up their cross and follow me. Find this fascinating. That all these years ago, Jesus links these two concepts of desire and denial. Two concepts that are hugely resonant in our culture today. It's so often our desires drive our decisions. So often in life, our desires are for the actualization of our self-interest. You know, we desire to find ourselves, to fulfill ourselves, to be true to ourselves, to promote ourselves, to elevate ourselves, to satisfy ourselves. And that leads us into places where we're seeking after wealth and fulfillment and success and high status and popularity, maybe just a desire to be desired. And they're not bad things in themselves, but there's such an emphasis on the self in our culture. And Jesus says, you're never going to find yourself by finding yourself. You'll only find yourself by losing yourself, giving yourself for me. It's almost like Jesus says here, there is a prior and greater desire that you can discover, which will enable you to lay down your self-interest. Thomas Chalmers, many years ago, the Scottish preacher preached a sermon called The Expulsive Power of a New Affection. And he said, seldom do our habits and flaws disappear by mere force of reason or willpower. said, willpower is not enough on its own. The only way to dispossess the heart of an old affection is by the expulsive power of a newer, greater affection. And that's something that the Holy Spirit, Acts 16:7, the Spirit of Jesus can form in you and create in you. And that, if I'm honest, is my experience. I still remember vividly my first year at university here. I was kind of hanging on by my fingertips. Scarcely a Christian at all. I knew I should read the Bible. I didn't want to. I found it boring. I knew I should go to church. I didn't want to. I found it boring. I knew I should hang out with some Christians. I didn't want to. I found them annoying. They were very different then. Very different to the people at the Six. And then the Holy Spirit set my heart on fire. And I tell you, in a day, I picked up the Bible and I read it for like an hour. I was just like, these are the most amazing words ever spoken. And they're recorded for us. It's like the most extraordinary gift. This book is amazing. And then I went to church. I was like, church is okay. And then I started hanging out with some Christians. And I was like, I can learn from these people. But I wasn't able to force myself to do that. I wasn't able to push myself to do that. No habit or routine or rhythm would have got me there. I needed the Holy Spirit to set my heart on fire. It's so interesting because it's only possible if our desire for Jesus is greater than the other desires in our life. That's the only way you can deny yourself. And I think it's so interesting because I was speaking to a friend who leads a little church in California a few days ago. And he's based in LA, and so particular context, but he was saying, it's interesting, he said the lean towards the self is so strong, he said, in the culture of my city, that actually even when you start a set of spiritual practices, even when you form a rule of life, quite quickly it becomes about me. So it's like my prayer, my Bible, my Sabbath, my boundaries, my this, my that, my other, my spiritual journey, what I need to thrive, what I need from my church, me. He says it quite quickly just becomes another vehicle for project self. And so that's why I find so fascinating that Jesus' own words root discipleship in two movements, the denial of self and the taking up of the cross. I'm going to put myself down and I'm going to pick the cross up. And that's completely countercultural. You know, the goal of spiritual disciplines is not to insulate you from the challenges of life. It's not to separate you from the storms of life. It's not so you can build barriers and bridges so high that the waves of life can't touch you in any way. The goal of spiritual disciplines is to better position you to give your life away to Jesus and give your life away to other people, knowing you can trust him because he's given his life for you. Not just about you separating yourself from all the challenges that are there in life, or separating yourself from the stresses of your friendship group or your workplace. That's not the purpose. The purpose is to enable you to live in the midst of that storm, confident, because you know Jesus has taken hold of you and he's not going to let go of you. Because he's willing to go to hell and back to bring you back to God. Jesus says, take up your cross. I don't know if you've noticed, you know, we have a little cross here. Rarely a cross is convenient. Each person has their own cross to bear, and yours might look very different from mine and probably very different from everyone else in this room. But your cross will interfere with your life. Your cross will mess with your plans. Your cross will mess with your boundaries, and your hopes and your dreams. But all the most exciting things in life are just on the other side of our self-interest. They come when you give your life away. And I've made lots of mistakes in my life. I've messed up more times than I care to remember. I've made all sorts of failures and got things wrong. But whenever I've laid my life down in big or small ways, tried to put my self-interest behind the interest of others, behind I think Jesus' purpose is, I've always sensed him so close and I've always known him to be faithful. In times in life, it's been really painful to do that, even to the extent I would say, I always hesitate to say this because it feels wrong, but almost like it has felt a little bit like taking up a cross. Maybe a handful of times I've experienced that. And I can tell you, even then, he's good, he's true, and he is faithful. And you can trust him. What does it mean to be a disciple? To be a disciple means to give your life away daily to serve God and others out of love for Jesus, embracing the cost and discipline and perseverance that comes with that. You can do it, like my friend in LA. You can do it in Singapore working for a company all the hours God sends. You can do it in the creative industries. You can do it in a church. You can do it in a university. You can do it in all sorts of different contexts. You can do it in a prison camp in North Korea, facing persecution and endless imprisonment. There are as many paths as people, but it will cost two things. It will cost your self-interest. It will lead you towards selflessness, and it will lead you towards sacrifice. And we want to, as a church, we want to position you as best as we can. We want to make you excited. We want to encourage you, and we want to equip you to work out what it means in your sphere, in your context, to follow Jesus in such a way that he can make you into something distinct. He can make you into a disciple. And we're committed to doing that. We've got great groups, great student groups, great adult groups, great good ground and break ground, great discipleship pathways. We're going to be doing other things in the coming months just to try and equip you wherever God has positioned you. Jesus invites you to follow him. Jesus promises to form you. And then thirdly, Jesus wants to partner with you. I love this. He says, come follow me and I'll make you into fishers of people. It's fascinating. To be a disciple is to be generative. It's to be self-replicating of what Jesus has done in you. What Jesus does in you is rarely to be kept to yourself. It's to be passed on. This is one of the only times in the Gospels that Jesus talks about what it practically means to be a disciple in terms of what you become, in terms of what you produce, in terms of what the outcome is. He says, come follow me. Doesn't say I'll make you holier than everyone else. Doesn't say I'll make you super spiritual. Doesn't say I'll make you more knowledgeable than everyone else. Doesn't say I'll give you better theology than everyone else. He says, come follow me and I will make you into someone who helps others find and follow me. It's almost like the image is like a peloton. You know, in a cycle race, you have a peloton where the group of cyclists come together. It's almost like Jesus is leading the peloton, taking the strain, pulling the peloton along, and then we can join it. We're like in the middle. We're like, at times we feel like we're adding to it. At times we feel like we're just being caught up in the draft of Jesus. He's like pulling us along. And then other people can join on behind us and join us in that race. It's not static. It's dynamic. It's moving. And I love in this passage that Jesus instantly contextualizes this call. He says, come follow and I'll make you fishers of people. A metaphor which is right where he finds them. He meets them right where they are. On the northern coast of the Sea of Galilee, right on the edge of Israel, right on the edge of the Sea of Galilee, right on the edge of the lake, he's there. Not in Jerusalem, not in the temple, not where they expect God to be. In the midst of their workplaces, in the midst of their day-to-day lives. That's where he meets them. That's where he calls them. And Jesus, we know Jesus is present where two or three are gathered in his name. That's why we sense his presence so closely as we worship here. But Jesus is also present with people who have not yet met him. He's present in the bar at your uni. He's present in the office before that difficult conversation with a colleague. He's present here, he's present there, he's present wherever he's positioned you. Because Leslie Newbegin, a church planter for the last century, said this. He said, the deepest motive for mission is simply the desire to be with Jesus where he is, on the frontier between the reign of God and the usurped dominion of the devil. Jesus is to be found in the places near the people of your life who seem to be furthest from the holiest places. Yeah, and you are positioned there to follow after him, to go where he goes, to see what he does, and to hallow those places he has placed you for him. I don't find this very easy. It still surprises me. Constantly surprised by what Jesus is up to and what he's doing. Often I encounter him in places that I have no reason for him to be there. I was at a shop in the Westgate Shopping Centre in the centre of Oxford. And I was just chatting to this guy. It turns out he was the manager of the shop. And after we'd been chatting for a little while, he said, I can't remember how it came up that I go to church, which I do actually. And he said, "Oh, what church do you go to?" And I said, "I go to this one in the centre." He said, "Is that the one called St. Aldgate's?" And I said, "That's the one. That's the one. No one can say it, don't worry." And he's like, "Oh, right, I've heard of that church. I've met some people who go there." And I said, "Okay." I said, "Oh, wow." And then we were just there. And suddenly in that moment, I felt the presence of God in that shop in the Westgate, as much as I felt in big conferences, loads of people worshiping on a Sunday. I was like, "Oh, it feels like Jesus is here. That's strange." And then he started welling up. And then I started welling up. And I said to him, I said, is there someone like, have you got someone in your family who like prays?" He said, my grandma prays. And we had this kind of moment. And I suddenly thought, oh, Jesus is already here. Like, he's gone ahead. Now, I'm useless at that stuff. But if Jesus has gone ahead, then all things are possible. If Jesus has gone ahead into your college, he's gone ahead into your uni, he's gone ahead into your halls, he's gone ahead into your flat share. Jesus has gone ahead into your workplace, in your context, in your business, your hospital, your school. He's gone ahead of you. And that means when you're crossing the threshold of that place, you're not on your own. He is with you and he is able to help you. You're not sent there. You know, when you become a Christian, it's not like you're handed a little gold Jesus like a Buddha. And you're like, "Thanks." And then you put him somewhere in your house. And so in the morning, you have a little prayer time, you know, you chat to your little Buddha. And then you kind of close the door and you go out. And then you're off on your own. And then you might come back later on and say, "Oh, Jesus, how'd it go? Your little coaching session." No, Jesus is not static. By his Spirit, he's on the move. Jesus came to seek and save the lost. Hasn't lost any of his power, any of his passion. He's out there. And the amazing privilege of this call is that we get to partner with him. We get to be caught up with him. We get to see what he does and be part of what he's doing. You're never on your own in a context. He's there. He goes ahead of you. And the amazing thing is we need people right across the sectors. You know, we need people bringing redemptive potential into entrepreneurship and tech and healthcare and education and finance, and scholarship and businesses, families, even the church. We need redemptive coffee. We need redemptive transformation. As you follow him, his dust rubs off on you. And that dust rubs off on the people around you. You'll leave his dust in the places you are this week. You can follow him close. You can trust him to make you into something new. And you can trust that he will bring his transforming words and his transforming actions into the places he's placed you. In Jesus' name, amen.